So when you guys, respected journalists and business people, say South Africa must adopt diplomacy, it won't help for South Africa not to be diplomatic. South Africa has been diplomatic, but it is dealing with a partner who's not interested in diplomacy and wants to draw blood. He won't stop until there's blood on the floor. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Readiness Report with me, Ridi Kabi, and the Daily Maverick. Catching my breath after a great trip to South Africa covering the G20 and all other side events related to it. It was a success. I don't care what you read, where, it was a success. But this week we wake up to information that the United States is hosting the B20 Sherpa on the 15th and 16th of December and South Africa is not invited. And even that whole language of invitation is absurd because South Africa is a fully fledged member of the G20. I wrote previously that the G20 is not some barbecue, neighborhood barbecue, where the United States can decide to snub this neighbor or that neighbor. But the point is, the optics are playing out in a very combative and aggressive manner. I called a couple of people in South Africa and the United States. Diplomats and officials here in the US are very embarrassed by what Trump does. Foreign policy on Twitter, I still call it Twitter, foreign policy on social media, and often they don't even know that he has done these things or said these things. So many are going apoplectic that South Africa is not invited and so on. I do think that we need to just raise the level of debate. There are some very pertinent issues that affect our lives as members of the human race. And there are pertinent themes that the South African G20, the first on African soil, was dealing with. But the reality is that you have a particular relationship with the United States that I think is not very constructive. We'll get to the B20 and the outcomes in just a moment, but I just want to address something. I want to get something off my chest. I've read opinion pieces by very respected people and some comments by very prominent business leaders in South Africa, some of whom have led JSE-listed companies. And they are imploring, they are beseeching South Africa to adopt diplomacy in their engagement with the United States. It's exasperating. It is a very untruthful framing of what is going on. What is it, pray tell, that South Africa has done? Which tool of diplomacy and engagement has South Africa not used in the past year to try and get through to the United States and build a bridge, a platform on which constructive engagement has happened? These arguments are disingenuous. They just try to posit this this picture of South Africa being a recalcitrant, uncooperative partner. And it's not true. It isn't true. Why do I say that? There've been delegations coming to Washington, and some coming from Washington to South Africa. So those conversations have been happening. Every time Solidarity and AfriForum and Donald Trump and MAGA post this untruth, absolute mendacity about a genocide, a white genocide, South Africa has calmly put the facts on the table and said there is no such thing. Every time they say there are 100 and whatever race laws, South Africa has addressed that. They've even invited Mr. Trump to a dialogue so that as two interlocutors, they can fight each other. So when you guys, respected journalists and business people, say South Africa must adopt diplomacy, it won't help for South Africa not to be diplomatic. South Africa has been diplomatic, but it is dealing with a partner who's not interested in diplomacy and wants to draw blood. He won't stop until there's blood on the floor. And you know what? Let's be bold. Claim your nonsense. When you say South Africa must be diplomatic, what do you mean? Tell us what you think South Africa should do that it hasn't been doing. I think you just don't have the guts to say what you truly mean. You just want South Africa to roll over and let Trump break every single rule. You are saying that South Africa must give Mr. Trump every single thing that Trump wants. Hello, my friends. I'm an international relations student. That's not diplomacy. Diplomacy and foreign relations is not one partner bending over while the other breaks the rules. South Africa has played by protocols. It has played by the rules. So I think you guys need to be bold in South Africa and say, you want South Africa to say yes, boss. That's what you want. You want South Africa to say yes, 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 boss. And that means you haven't understood the psychology of a post-apartheid South Africa. A post-apartheid South Africa with all its flaws is not going to allow a kind of imperialist foreign policy where a small country at the tip of Africa gets kicked around because it doesn't have the matching economic and military might. Secondly, South Africa is playing in this multilateral framework. EU partners, partners from the Global South, they've all cooperated with South Africa because there is no law or rule that South Africa has broken. There's one person who's breaking the norms, who's breaking the decency that informs multilateral cooperation and bilateral relationships. So I'm just saying, those of you who keep saying South Africa must be diplomatic, South Africa has been. South Africa must engage Trump. South Africa has tried. Say what you mean, that South Africa must just say yes, bus. And I don't see that happening. It's not good for us. It's not good for international law. It's not good for foreign policy. I wonder if you could take a leaf out of Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister. I think it was 2 days ago. Well, I'm recording this now, 2 days from the moment I'm talking to you now. I just want to read what he said. He said, "We know that this decades-long process of our ever closer economic relationship between Canada and the United States has ended." That is dramatic for Canada to say that. But he also said something else. He said, "Canada's decades-long economic reliance on the United States is now a vulnerability, not a strength. The so-called partnership that once fueled growth has turned into a leash." This was a not so subtle message by the Canadian Prime Minister. He is saying, essentially, that America's instability is now a national risk to Canada, and that Canada needs to insulate itself, trade beyond its shadow, and rebuild a system that doesn't collapse every time Washington elects chaos. That's how partners of the United States are framing this. Washington elects chaos, and everybody must play along with that. You are not addressing the lie of the white genocide. How do you engage diplomatically with that? You are not addressing the lie of the hundreds of race laws. How do you suggest South Africa deals with it? And quite frankly, it is quite insulting to me as a black person and to many other black people to be depicted as these marauding savages who are killing white people. And when you, mainly white business and white commentators, tell South Africa to be diplomatic in the face of a lie that goes to the heart of our identity, that goes to the heart of a very colonial, racist depiction of dark Africans as savages. We're not savages. And you can't tell us now in 2024 that we must accept that kind of racist framing. I'm done. I'm done with my rant. Let's get to the conversation now. Today's conversation is grounded in what actually came out of the B20. The formal communique and the 8 task force recommendations. We'll walk through some of those outcomes, reflect on their meaning, and probe what needs to happen next, especially for South Africa and the wider Global South. What a joy to be joined by Cass Kuvadia, who headed the B20 Shepa for South Africa. Have you rested yet, Cass? Welcome to the Readiness Report.
Thanks for having me. I'm trying to rest, really.
But, you're trying to rest.
Getting there.
Okay, let me just get your sense of the outcome of the B20. I called it a success. What word would you use to describe South Africa's G20?
Well, let me use some of the discussions I had with global business leaders at the B20. And virtually every one of them said that they've attended a number of B20 and this was the best one they attended. Not just from the point of view of the logistics and what we put up, we showed, depicted what South African and African culture is. We depicted what South African and African food is. We showed the caliber of people we have in this country and on this continent through the content of the summit and the discussion at the summit and debates at the summit. And a number of business people told me that they came here with a perception about South Africa and the continent. They're leaving with a very different and more positive perception that will inform their investment decisions. And that's what I wanted to hear. So I think that it was very successful. I think that that week was a good week for South Africa and the continent, something we need to be proud of. And that was the overwhelming feeling, pride for to be South African and the continent and to be happy.
All right. So I mentioned that the B20 produced 30 actionable recommendations across 8 task forces. We don't have time to deal with all of them, but I know the priorities were grouped under several strategic themes, trade and investment, finance infrastructure, digital transformation, sustainable food systems, energy mix, just transition, all of that. But I guess what I want to ask of you is, how much emphasis did you place as South Africa on measurable implementation and accountability? What does it look like? We've had this whole year-long interaction and presidency of the G20. How do we know, how do we track and ensure that that which was agreed upon is actually happening?
Yeah, so really this has been one of the issues with the B20, because neither the B20 nor the G20 has the permanent secretary. And so usually the host country does what it wants to do, goes through a thorough process of arriving at recommendations, which are then handed over, and then nobody knows what happens to them. So we, right up front, agreed that we're going to fashion the recommendations in a way that the recommendations have clear outcomes, clear measurables over a period of time. And I've been talking to the Brazilian Sherpa, obviously to the U.S. Sherpa, and when I was in London, I talked to the Confederation of British Industries because they're taking over in 2027, to see if we can to start with at least pull together some sort of mechanism between these four Sherpas to track those recommendations. And not just to track them to see if they are being implemented, but to also measure the impact of the implementation. So for example, if access to digital infrastructure, and I'm just throwing around figures, currently looks at 30% of the world population has access. We then say, here are the recommendations. This is the organization that should be implementing them. And usually the G20 countries farm that out to some multilateral organization. And if implemented, this should be the impact. By 2030, we should have not 30% having access to digital infrastructure, but 80% of people having access. And these are things that organizations like the World Bank and others track anyway. So it's not as if we'd have to go through long processes to track this. So we're trying to do that. Because we certainly felt that B20 representing business needs to look at implementation, needs to track impact. Otherwise, these people start losing interest in, and I don't blame them. We don't want to become a policy pork shop. We want to bring these people together from the G20 countries, from the African continent, from the EU. Go through serious processes to arrive at policy recommendations, but then we want to track impact. And if impact is not sufficient, then to come back and actually ask ourselves, what do we do?
Yeah. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we don't have time to look at every single strategic area, but I want to talk about the mobilizing capital for sustainable infrastructure and just transition. And this theme, under this theme, so many people, so many things are embedded. Innovation, development, youth unemployment. This is an area that offers so much promise. So it is one of the core outcomes in the call for mobilizing private investment and blended finance for sustainable infrastructure. I guess I want to ask the question, what did the B20 come up with in terms of identifying the obstacles to this large-scale mobilization? In practical terms, what would you say are the main structural barriers that must be overcome for that capital to flow into Africa and other emerging markets?
Well, the one thing, so let's look at this in two sort of areas. The one is that one of the areas we've identified to actually attract investment is to ensure that we get the infrastructure in place, to ensure that we have all the instruments and the environment in place to enable trade and investment to actually be put into place and be managed in a way that investors feel happy, investors are comfortable with investing there, and that goods, services, and people can be moved without unnecessary delays, without visas at every African border, and so on and so on. Get our rail system sorted out. Open the continent up for movement of people. Enable the continent to negotiate as a continent and not set the country on some of the platform issues that need to be negotiated on the back of which countries can compete. And I don't, and we should encourage that. We should encourage competition. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of stuff for the continent to do and get its act together. And we believe the African Continental Free Trade Area is the instrument to which to do this. But there are also other issues, like, for instance, we've certainly said that we believe that countries in Africa, from a risk point of view, are being rated on an unlevel playing field. We're not saying don't rate for us. We're not saying don't put a premium on the risk if there's a need to put premium. But we are saying provide the appropriate information, provide the data, and allow risk issues to be determined by data and information. Because given where the world is today, there are some countries in the north that are probably riskier than some countries in Africa.
Yes. Eh? Yeah.
I mean, if you talk of uncertainty and so on, and business wants certainty, business wants continuity, business wants to be looking at long-term certainty so that they can make long-term investments. Well, there are countries in the north that don't provide that. So all we're saying is that unlock some of these issues where countries in Africa appear to be treated on an unlevel playing field. So level the playing fields, treat us as you would any other country on a risk rating basis. I think we're also saying that countries in Africa under very difficult circumstances have shown resilience. So there are countries that have been war-torn and so on, but business still happen, things still happen, because they are resilient, and that needs to be looked at as an asset rather than a liability. So we certainly would want to engage with rating agencies, critical investors, to actually enable them to understand exactly what's happening on the continent. So one of the rating agencies, can't recall which one now, has expanded their presence on the continent. And one of the reasons they gave for that was that they want to understand the continent better. Well, then it raises the question, on what basis have they been rating countries?
Yes, exactly. Okay? That's exactly what I'm thinking. What has been going on all along if you don't have that empirical evidence?
So there's a bucket of issues that we have to actually really work together and do ourselves. And then there's a bucket of issues where we would want to engage with rating agencies and others that actually look at risk on the continent and ensure that that is done on a level playing field and it's based on appropriate data and information.
Yeah.
As you talked about blended finance and other structures of finance, and I mean, we've been talking to a number of people. So philanthropy, major philanthropy want to get involved now in infrastructure financing. So we can approach different sources of funding and right up front say, for this particular project, these are the sources of funding available, and this is how we should be structured so as to manage costs, so as to look at short-term and long-term funding and a blend of those. And I think there's possibility to do.
Yeah. And I think what you were just saying about ratings agencies, I just want to make this particular point that this whole philosophy around how Africa is rated is also relevant when we talk about the debt, sovereign debt, and how it is structured,
Exactly.
where you find countries like Italy, because they're in the global north, can borrow at a lower rate. And yet your Tanzania and Malawi have to redirect resources for education and health because they are regarded as risky. They're using all that money. 48%, I think, in Malawi of GDP goes towards financing debt costs in Tanzania as well. So Africa is paying at a higher interest rate. And there's just this perception that African treasuries or African governments are just irresponsible and wasting money. No, global north countries, America, Europe, they borrow money too. They borrow money too, but at a lower rate. And the repayment terms are favorable and structured towards their economic growth. And that's not the case here in Africa. Look, Cass, we don't have a lot of time to deal with this particular matter. I think it's important, particularly because the US is now the president of the G20 and they're going to set the agenda. We know that the US administration is very skeptical, or perhaps I'm serious about climate responsiveness. I don't want to put you to ambush you and get you into the politics, but let's just talk about climate financing because it was a very big theme of South Africa's G20 B20 trade, investment, climate responsiveness, and Africa's global position. The B20, if I understand, recommended embedding climate responsiveness in trade rules and supporting trade frameworks to boost Africa's competitiveness. Are you concerned about this area, given that the incoming the incumbent, shall I call them? I don't really care about this.
Well, we are. I mean, it's not it, climate change is obviously a critical element of that, but we are also concerned about other transformation and development issues that the B20 has looked at. So, I mean, we've talked about climate resistant trade system, climate resistant finance. So, climate change is obviously critical to this. Now, look. As I said, the American administration could pull the G20 back to what it originally was, a finance track. We have to see what happens. But I think that certainly from a B20 point of view, we want to try and work with the American Chamber of Commerce in Washington to see how we can help them withstand what might happen on the political side and keep at least the B20 part of it going. And going successfully, and see how we manage the politics as it unfolds. I mean, I agree with you that the US or President Trump can't decide who's part of the G20 and who's not part of the G20. And I think our government needs to participate and needs to make it very clear that they will be participating in the G20. And I think we need to try and navigate our way through that. But we've also been speaking to the UK business people to say, in the event that things really go bad from a business B20 point of view in the US, then Britain will need to pick up some of those pieces and make sure that we don't lose those permanent. But it's a moving field, and we'll have to see how it goes.
In fact, that was my position a couple of days ago, to say, okay, fine, you can't have everybody boycott. There are people who are saying G20 member states must boycott the US B20. I'm ambivalent about that. I'm not sure that it helps. I think it inflames matters. Or you could have those who understand these priorities, who understand the importance of the G20. And something that we seldom speak about is how the G20 came to be in the first place. It came to be as a result of a global economic crisis in Brazil, in Asia, right? So people talk about it as though it's just some beautiful party that was put together and the US can just invite and disinvite. It was, and there was a concerted decision and intention to include the global south. We're not there by accident.
Absolutely.
It is because when there's
Absolutely.
a glo there's an economic crisis in one part of the world, it reverberates and affects another. So that is why this is a body that is meant to prevent a financial a crisis. So just to go back to that, I was thinking there'll be adults back in the room at the end of 2026, November. And the UK
Absolutely.
understands South Africa. The Prime Minister was on the Gautrain in Johannesburg. And they need to understand that they have a moral and economic duty and responsibility to elevate some of the decisions and recommendations that came out of South Africa G20. And perhaps South Africa, rather than hitting its head against the wall, should just be talking to those partners. What are your thoughts? Do you think they should boycott America's G20?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. As our president said when he was interviewed a few days before the G20, boycotts aren't productive. Rather, all work together. And so I don't think we should boycott it, but I think that we should keep our options open and have robust discussions with the British, both at the G20 level and the B20 level.
And also keeping in mind that there's a difference between the resident on Pennsylvania at the White House. There's a difference between him, between Congress, between the Senate. Yeah. There's also a difference between that and U.S. businesses, because there was a big cohort, I believe, yes, of U.S. businesses at B20 South Africa.
Absolutely, yes. And U.S. business has been consistently supportive during the year. They participated in the task force. Some of them have been co-chairs of the task force. And when President Trump, I think on that Friday before the G20, announced that U.S. will not be there, I thought I'll wait until Monday to contact our business contacts to see what's the impact of that. I didn't have to wait until Monday. Over that weekend, I got messages from everybody to say, Kath, it's all on track. Don't worry about this. We'll be there. And that's very gratifying. Yeah.
Okay. So, Kaz, we'll continue having these conversations and congratulations on a successful presidency. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, really. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Kaz Kavadia was the B20 Shepherd for South Africa. And it's very detailed. And that's what I keep saying. Don't get caught up in the drama and the optics. Of course, they're important. But I think sometimes we really must take responsibility for the information that we expose ourselves to, the things we discuss, the things we read. If we are to center development and the future of our country and our region, then I think we can start extricating the important stuff and separating the manure from the real stuff. That's the Readiness Report, folks. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.